Well, it's nice to be here with you guys, and I'm really glad that you're here too, not particularly just so that you can listen to me, but here in the sense that you're a part of this group and that you believe in this ministry, because for me, it was really at uni through this ministry that I got converted. And actually, it was funny, it was sitting in a lunchtime meeting like this, listening to a guy preach on Romans 12. That's what got me into full-time ministry. So, and it's the same for a lot of the guys that I know, actually, that are now pastors all around Hobart, and some have even wound up overseas. So it's an important thing to be involved in. I'll just lead us in one more prayer, and then we'll start looking at Isaiah 9. Father, thanks for this amazing prophecy. Thank you for the man Isaiah, and the scriptures that you've given us through him, and for the very powerful way that they spoke all the way back then, but just for the really amazing, life-changing things that they've got to say to us now. It's extraordinary stuff. It's stuff that we need to think about and engage with, and we just pray that you'd really help us to do that now. It's so easy to listen to Bible teaching just as a TV show or some kind of performance, and yet we know that that's not the case. It's something that we have to engage in and be involved in. We have to process. And most of all, Bible teaching isn't complete without Bible doing. And so we ask that your Spirit would be at work in our hearts. May he help us to concentrate, and may he give us the courage to go out of here and actually start living out the attitudes and the mindsets and the actions that this passage calls us to. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, I want to read you some Bono lyrics. Heaven on earth, we need it now. I'm sick of all this hanging around. I'm sick of the sorrow. I'm sick of the pain. I'm sick of hearing again and again that there's going to be peace on earth. Tell the ones that hear no sound, whose sons are living in the ground, peace on earth. No who's or why's, no one cries like a mother cries for peace on earth. Jesus and the song you wrote, the words are sticking in my throat, peace on earth. I hear it every Christmas time. But hope and history won't rhyme. So what's it worth, this peace on earth? And look, you don't have to watch the international news for too long, really, before you start to sympathise with lyrics like that. And it's hard not just to get a little bit cynical when you're confronted just with the constant injustice and pain and war that just fills this planet. It's constant. So much in this world that is just so overwhelmingly bad and wrong and evil. And it doesn't matter how long John Lennon stays in bed or how many concert Bob Geldof organises. It doesn't matter how many Buddhist monks burn themselves alive or how many sort of summits, you know, the summits world leaders have, how many of those that happen. There just seems to be absolutely nothing anyone can do to fix it. And when that's getting in your face, it's hard not to feel just a bit frustrated with God and disillusioned with Jesus. Before most of you were born, Tasmania only had two television channels, and one of those was Taz TV. You may have heard about it in history or something like that. And on Taz TV, there used to be these ads called Christian Television Association ads. I don't know if you've ever heard of those. And there were people on there like Amy Grant, Christian singer, some other guy with curly 80s mullet hair style. And they used to sing this song, Jesus is the answer, Jesus is the way. The answer for all the world today. But oftentimes it doesn't feel like the answer. And I actually really appreciate Bono's honesty in that song, because I think he gives a really honest portrayal of that frustration. He just sort of taps into that mindset that can be a real problem for Christians. Sometimes you do get sick of hearing again and again that there's going to be peace on earth. Sometimes those big promises of peace and blessing and joy, you know, they just pop up all through the Bible. But sometimes they just sound so trite and shallow and hollow. In the face of real pain and real suffering, they seem like cliches. And this passage today, Isaiah chapter 9, it's one of the culprits. That's a very famous passage. Handel's Messiah's made sure of that. You will hear it every Christmas time. And as is the case with so many other very famous Bible passages, we tend to think that we know it really well. You know, it's one of those ones that you just sort of read, if you've been a Christian for a while, you just sort of skim over it, let it wash over you. But if we do that, we do that to our detriment. Because if we go for a deep understanding of Isaiah 9, it's going to do two things for us. Okay, it'll do two things for us. Firstly, it reveals that Jesus Christ really is, meaningfully is, the ultimate answer to worldwide peace and justice. It's the first thing it'll do. And the second thing that it does is that it's going to fuel our faith and fuel our perseverance despite the terrible violence and the injustice that's just everywhere. Okay, I'll say those two things again, because these are the two big things that we're really going to push for today and try and get our heads around. A deep understanding of Isaiah 9 will do these two things. Firstly, it will reveal that Jesus Christ really is the ultimate answer to worldwide peace and justice. And secondly, it's going to fuel our faith and perseverance in him despite all the terrible violence and injustice that's around us. So how do we get the deep understanding of this passage? Well, the first thing that we need to do is we need to spend a little bit of time, just a little bit, getting our heads around the context. We need to get our heads around the context. And if you're into taking notes and you like that sort of thing, that's kind of point one, really, the context, pretty simple. The context. Now, context is very important, and it's all the more important with literature. And I just want to use that U2 song a little bit to illustrate that, okay? The song's called Peace on Earth. You probably picked that up. Some of you may know it. It's the eighth track on an album that they did back in 2000 called All That You Can't Leave Behind. And it's written in response to the Omagh bombings that happened in Northern Ireland. That happened in 1998. It was carried out by the real IRA, and it killed 29 people, injured a further 220 of them. It was described by the BBC as Northern Ireland's worst single terrorist atrocity. And when you think about it, that's saying something. Worst. And once you get that context in place, the song starts to hit you at a bit of a deeper level, really. You start to get a hold of the grief and the frustration and the pain that comes across in the lyrics, the disillusionment. After all, you two are an Irish band, so this is something that's happening on their home turf. It'd be like a Tasmanian band writing about the Port Arthur massacre or something like that. The names that the song lists in one of its verses, Sarah, Julia, Gareth, Anne, Brader, they're all names of the people that died in that bombing. Another verse says that she never got to say goodbye to see the colour in his eye. Now he's in the dirt. And again, that's a reference to the funeral of a guy called James Barker who died in the bombing. Another victim of the bombing. The Irish Times quoted his mother as stating, "I never realised how green his eyes were. Never got to see the colour in his eyes." So if you get the context of things, it sort of makes everything more meaningful. You get behind it, it deepens your understanding. And if it does that to a song, it does it even more so to the Bible. And that's what I want to show you with Isaiah 9. So what is the context? Well, to put it overly simply, it's a context of judgment. It's a context of judgment. You see, up until chapter 9, Isaiah has been dealing with the sinfulness and the faithlessness of God's people in general, and their king in particular. And all of this sin and all of this faithlessness has brought the judgment of God upon them in the form of the Assyrian Empire, one of the greatest and most ruthless superpowers of the ancient world. And what's going to happen is that empire is going to come crashing down upon them. It's going to destroy their lands. It's going to exile their people and all but utterly wipe them out. And if you've got your Bibles open, you might like to just turn the page backwards, back to chapter 8. I want to read to you from verse 7. Isaiah describes it like this. This is chapter 8 and verse 7. Therefore, the Lord's about to bring against them the mighty floodwaters of the river, the king of Assyria with all his pomp. It will overflow all its channels. It's going to run over all its banks. It's going to sweep on into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land. It's grim. Now, that's bad news for any nation. But it's particularly bad news for the ancient Jews. Because it actually raises for them some pretty serious issues about their God, about their spirituality. You see, key to Israel's history are some promises that God made to the great King David. And what God promised David was that in him and through him and through the kings that would then follow on from his line, that there would come a mighty king one day who would give his people their own land, a country of their own that would give his people rest from all their enemies, that all the wicked people would no longer disturb them. It's wonderful promises for people. And that's key in Israel's thinking. It's key to the way that they think about their relationship with God and what he's doing amongst them. And you can see that in places like 2 Samuel 7, for example. That's the big one. But here's the problem for them. Here in Isaiah, it seems as though God is giving up on those promises. Seems like he's chucking them in. Instead of having rest from their enemies, chapter 8, you see that the enemies are going to come in and all but utterly wipe them out. Instead of God giving them their own safe land, a place of rest, he's taking it off them and he's giving it to Assyria. And in the exile, he ends up sending them out of that land. Raises some pretty serious questions. If Bono feels frustrated and disillusioned with God sometimes, well, that's nothing compared to what the ancient Jews would have felt. In fact, in chapter 8, verse 21, and if you've got chapter 8 open in front of you still, just look down at verse 21 with me, it shows you exactly how they felt. It says this, distressed and hungry, they're going to roam through the land. When they're famished, they will become enraged and looking upward will curse their God and their king. Anger, disillusionment, horror at the prospect of being abandoned by God. And that's the context. That's the context that we hear Isaiah 9 in. Isaiah wants to show people that despite this devastating judgment that they've brought upon themselves, despite that, God is still going to remain faithful to his promises. He will still bless his people through a king in David's line. And really all they've got to do is just stand firm, keep the faith, and persevere. So that's the context. The Jews have brought judgment upon themselves, but Isaiah actually wants to encourage them. He wants to encourage them to stand firm through it, that they might receive God's promised blessing. So let's get into the chapter itself. And I want to show you how it kind of does all that. Okay, so we've seen the context. Now let's take a look at the promise. It's kind of point two, the promise. Now, the promise that you get in Isaiah 9 here is staggering for four big reasons, really. Four big reasons. Firstly, just have a look with me at where the promise is launched. It's there in verse 1. We'll read out verse 1. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he will honour Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea along the Jordan.
Now, you're probably not overly familiar with lands like Zebulun and Naphtali. You may have heard of Galilee before. I mean, if you've read the Gospels, that pops up a bit there. But the thing to note is that all three of those places are actually very significant for a Jew living at this time. Very significant. If you lived during or after or around the Assyrian invasion, then those three places, Zebulun, Naphtali, Galilee, are very, very significant. Just imagine for a moment if World War I had been absolutely disastrous for Australia. It had wiped it out, destroyed it, obliterated it. We'd lost control. The country was more or less over. And then imagine if someone said, well, you know what? God's going to fix Australia, and he's going to do it starting in Gallipoli. Starting in that place where thousands and thousands and thousands of Australians were just utterly butchered. He's going to fix Australia, and it's all going to start in Gallipoli. That's kind of what Isaiah is saying, but in the Israel equation. You see, Naphtali, Zebulun and Galilee are more or less the same northern region of Israel that borders Syria. And when the Assyrian army attacked, it came in from the north. That's how it came. So Zebulun, Naphtali, Galilee, those places were the regions that were slammed first by Assyria. Utterly wiped out, completely and thoroughly conquered. They copped the first force of that invasion. They were totally dominated. The king of Assyria exiled all the Jews that were living there, and he posted his own people there instead to kind of keep control of it. That's why it's Galilee of the Gentiles, by the way, because it's full of Assyrians. And yet, it's there, that spot, where God is going to re-establish his people and begin this whole re-establishment process. It's a striking thing to say. And what's the point of it? Well, I think it just shows you the extreme extent by which God is going to bring blessings to bear on his people. After all, if it's going to start in the worst possible place, the place that's been so utterly destroyed, just imagine what it's going to be like in the places that weren't that badly harmed. Just imagine what it's going to be like there. Well, that's the first striking feature of the promise. It's where the promise is launched. But the second feature is what the promise achieves. And you can see that in verse 2. Verse 2, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. Now, the whole light-darkness imagery is very, very significant. If you go back to Genesis, you see that before creation, before anything was made, there was only darkness. And what's the very first thing God makes? It's light. Let there be light. And he sees the light, and the light is good, and he separates it from the darkness. You see, the act of bringing light into darkness is symbolic of God's creative work. We've already seen, haven't we, how God's judgment through Assyria brought destruction and de-creation to God's people. In chapter 8 and at the beginning of chapter 9, you see that this destruction and judgment is described as darkness. Did you notice that when we read it? It's darkness, it's gloom, it's the shadow. That's what the decreation, that's what the destruction is, it's darkness. And what the literature is trying to do for us here, what it's trying to convey, is that it's almost like the people have been decreated. His land, all the blessings have been undone. They were light and they've been made dark. But here in verse 2, there's going to be light. There's going to be recreation. Once again, there's going to be light. He's going to make them new. all of the ruin and misery and destruction, all of that's going to be taken and recreated. And he's going to restore the great, joyous nation, verse 3. So we've seen where the promise is launched. That was the first striking feature. We've seen what the promise achieves. That's the second striking feature. It's a recreation. But the third striking feature is what it looks like. And this is just beautiful. Because there's freedom, verse 4. Freedom. Just as God has delivered his people from their oppressors, just as he's done that in the past, he's going to do it again. But there's more than freedom. There's also great peace, verse 5. All the warriors' gear is going to get burnt up because you're not going to need warriors anymore in this new world because it's all peaceful. And note that the new king is described as the Prince of Peace, verse 6. And love, verse 7. And the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Endless peace. And at the end of that verse, his kingdom will be established with justice and righteousness. Now, isn't that what we all want? To have the world governed like that. Endless peace. Perfect justice. Complete righteousness. Well, that's what Bono's craving in that song. Peace on earth. Wants it now. Justice, righteousness, freedom for everyone. It's just a glorious vision of a wonderful recreation. Well, we've seen where it was launched. We've seen what it achieves. We've seen what it looks like. But we finally see who does it. And that's there in verse 6. Just read verse 6 with me. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. The new king, the one that's descended from David, the one who is the fulfillment of God's promises in 2 Samuel 7, is himself God. That's who it is. And that's a striking thought in and of itself, isn't it? God come to earth to rule and protect his people. But here's the thing, as striking as that sounds, it's actually not surprising when you think about it, because if the restoration of Israel is a recreation, if that's what's required, if we have to have things recreated, remade, well then you've got to have a creator God to do that, don't you? No one else can recreate. You've got to have God to do that work. In fact, if this broken world that we live in now is ever to come close to representing this vision here in Isaiah 9, then nothing less than the zeal of the Lord Almighty is going to accomplish that, verse 7. We need the Creator God to come in and recreate. The zeal of God can do that. And that's the radical nature of this promise. The radical nature. But for another 700 years, that's all it was ever going to be. Just a promise. And you could imagine, couldn't you, like a good half a millennium later, not a few Jews would be starting to get a little bit cynical. To quote Bono, sick of hearing again and again, there's going to be peace on earth. Oh yeah, we've been saying that since Isaiah's time. Where is it? They'd be ruled by Assyria. They'd be all but utterly destroyed by Babylon. they'd be inherited and ruled by Persia. I don't know what the Greeks did with them, but it probably wouldn't have been that great. In the New Testament, by the time we get there, they're under Roman rule. There's no freedom. There's no justice. There's no peace. None of it for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And as I pointed out in the introduction, this is where we might well relate to the ancient Jews. Now, this is where we echo Bono's song, because it's been about 2,500 years since Isaiah wrote this stuff down. A couple of thousand years. Thanks to Handel, we do hear it again and again every Christmas time, but hope and history don't rhyme, do they? Where is the peace? Where is the heaven on earth? Where's the justice? Well, it's true that the peace isn't here yet in all of its glorious fullness. That is true, that much is obvious when you look around. But the thing is that you, me, and Bono are all in a very different situation to those ancient Jews. Very different. Because although they had the promise, as we do, we've actually seen a good deal of this promise fulfilled already. A good deal of it. And they didn't see that. They never got that. But we've seen a large chunk of it already fulfilled. All right, so we've looked at the context. We've looked at the promise. Now, I just want us to finish up, and we're nearly there, so just bear with me for a little bit longer, because this is really where I think Isaiah 9 is pointing us to. We've seen the context, we've seen the promise. Now I want us just to look at the fulfillment. We're going to finish on this. But it's interesting. At the beginning of Matthew's Gospel, in chapter 4, we read these words. When Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he returned to Galilee. Remember, that's in Isaiah 9. That's where it's all going to start. Jesus returned to Galilee, leaving Nazareth. He went and lived in Capernaum, which was by the lake, in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, which again we've seen in Isaiah 9. And he did that to fulfill what was said through the prophet Isaiah. Land of Zebulun and land of Naphtali, the way to the sea, along the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people living in darkness have seen a great light. A light has shined on those living in the land of the shadow of death. You see, the thing that we know, the thing that we've seen, that those ancient Jews never got to, is that the child has been born. The child of Isaiah 9 has been born. A child who is both fully man and fully almighty God. A man who John chapter 1 actually describes as the light. That's his name in John 1. And whilst the new creation is not yet here in all of its fullness, Jesus brought with him a very real taste of it. A very real taste of it. Evidence of it. Now, you see him, if you read the Gospels, you see him liberating people from evil. We see him controlling the creation around him, moulding it, shaping it, stopping it, making it do stuff. You see him in charge of so much of the pain and the suffering that ruins life. You see him cure life-threatening diseases. Jesus is actually heaven on earth. We needed it now, or we got it in him. He brings with him a taste of heaven on earth. But it wasn't just here when he was on earth, because the effects of the new creation, they echo on and have done for a couple of thousand years now in all that he's achieved. He's granted us all freedom from sin through his death on the cross and through his self-sacrifice. He's modelled for us the kind of self-sacrificial, other-centred love that this world so desperately needs if it's ever going to work. You know, if world communities are ever going to have peace, they've got to model themselves on Jesus. And self-sacrifice and others-centeredness. Through his Holy Spirit, he works in his followers. He recreates them. He enables them more and more to love the way that he loves and to bring peace the way that he brought peace. So, although it's not all here yet, when you really sit back and think about it, it's just staggering how much of it is here already. Staggering. So much of Isaiah 9 is here on earth. Jesus has shown us through his life, death and resurrection the reality of Isaiah 9. And as we live as his followers, you just get to taste it more and more and more and more. And this is the wonderful thing. Because God has already fulfilled so much of his promise, we can have certainty that he's going to come through with the rest. Okay, because you've seen him already fulfill so much of Isaiah 9, because you've seen him come through with the goods with so much of Isaiah 9, you can be sure that he is going to come through with the rest. And that perfect recreation of Isaiah 9 will one day be the reality in all of its fullness. Probably one of the most annoying things I remember as a teenager is the way that most of the time your parents end up being right about stuff. I don't know if anyone ever had experiences with their mum and dad like this. Yeah, especially when you happen to have a big fight about something and then you find out, now you really go to war on it. You sort of put yourself out there, you fight almost to the death, and then at the end of it you find out that they were right all along. I used to hate that. It's utterly frustrating. And the annoying thing, and you'll find this too the older you get, you realise more and more and more just how right they were about a whole heap of stuff, and that's even more annoying. But the reason they can do that so infuriatingly consistently is because they can look back at stuff. Yeah, they've been through it. Older people have just been through more than you have. So they can look back at stuff. They've seen how things work out. They've seen a whole heap of stuff happen before. And you'll get that too, that yeah, the older you get, the more you develop that skill. You can look back, you've seen things happen before. You realise that certain things aren't the end of the world. And you learn that sometimes, you know, you just got to hang in there. And before you know it, you'll find yourself saying very annoying things to younger people yourselves and utterly infuriating them. And this is the wonderful thing about Isaiah 9. We can look back. We can look back. We can look back at the fulfillment of that passage. We can do what the ancient Jews never did. For all the ancient Jewish people, this was just future. All completely and utterly future. But for us, a lot of this is past. But we can look back and see it. A lot of it's already been fulfilled. Now, it's good and right to be troubled about what you see in the world around you. Be sad about it. Grieve for it. You know, and like Bono, you can long for the fullness of recreation, absolutely. But don't get cynical. Don't get cynical. Don't doubt. And don't let go of Jesus. Now, it's interesting. Most of the major world organisations started out as Christian groups. It's an interesting fact. There's one that Evdoxia and I are connected to. It used to be called the Christian Child Fund. But recently they've dropped the word Christian off it. That's just child fun now. And that happens so often because I think for so many people, Jesus just seems to be so unnecessary and unimportant in this whole quest for world peace and fixing stuff up. Better just to drop him off and get on without him. Just drop him off the name. And it can be so tempting sometimes as a Christian to want to do that. He just doesn't seem to help. Better to drop him off. But I hope you can see from Isaiah 9 that that attitude is disastrous. At the end of the day, it is only Jesus, the one who is the recreating God, who can bring about world peace. Throughout Bono's song, he repeats these words. Jesus, can you take the time to throw a drowning man a line? Peace on earth. Well, I think Isaiah 9 shows us that Jesus has done exactly that. He has shown us peace on earth in this life. He's won it for us through his death and resurrection. He's increasing it as he grows and transforms his people. And we can be certain that one day he will lavish it upon us in all of its glorious form.